Is that red, white, and blue? Are you up for the U.S. men's national team manager job that I have?
No, this is actually Japan.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I got this in Qatar. I got a bunch of different ones, but I just love the Adidas hoodie. So,
yeah.
No, I wouldn't go near that U.S. manager's job, trust me.
that's smart. I think a couple big names feel the same way as you. I'm going deep. I feel like Halo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett. That's right, it's the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett, and I'm super nervous because the Three Lions of England, the country of my mother's birth, find themselves in the final of a major tournament once again. It's not relatively new, especially Spain facing off with England in the final of a major tournament. Spain beat England in the Women's World Cup final last year. England beat Spain in the under-21 Euro Cup final last year. And England now becomes the first side to get to a final after trailing in a quarterfinal and a semifinal. And I guess shout out to Gareth Southgate, because the pre-Southgate era and the post-Southgate era could not be more difficult. 2018 World Cup semifinal for Southgate. 2020 Euros final. 2022 World Cup quarterfinal. And now in 2024 is in a final and could win it. Ultimately, will they win it? I don't know. I'm going to ask someone who's followed the English national team for much longer than I, and who knows much more about soccer than I, Christian Jack, about that. But I'm actually going to start the conversation in the place of my birth and the chosen place for Christian Jack, and that would be Canada, specifically in our domestic soccer league here, the CPL, and our national team, given that they're coming off an outstanding Copa America performance. So much to talk about, so much good soccer on the brain. Who better to hang out with than Christian Jack? Let's go deep. So KJ, there's so much football to talk about right now that I don't even know where's best to start, but maybe I'll start with where the conversation went and ended for a couple pivotal people around our national team on the men's side. I found it somewhat interesting and instructive that both somewhat unprompted, Stephanie Stacchio and after Jesse Marsh mentioned development and pathways in terms of young players, and specifically mentioned the CPL. Now, obviously, my CPL knowledge is, you know, not near yours, but my understanding was there is infrastructure to make sure that young players are getting minutes. And so maybe one of the things Jesse Marsh will find out as he's settling into his job. But take me through, one, your reaction to their comments, and two, what actually is in place, speaking to the ethos and the spirit of what Marsh and Eustachio were mentioning.
Yeah, first of all, great to be with you again, my friend. First of all, it's refreshing that the Canadian Premier League is getting more and more discussion, right? I just feel like sometimes in Canada, it can be quite a fractured, agenda-driven discussion when it comes to the game around it. But this is what happens all around the world. If you've got a true culture of the sport in the country, you talk about it in this manner. And the fact that we haven't talked about this league enough maybe says a lot about why we are where we are today. So it's great that players like, you know, vice captain and former national team manager Stephan Eustachio was mentioning that. He obviously has a great passion in it as well, with his brother being an assistant coach at York United. So he's obviously following it for his own reasons as well. And then Jesse Marsh coming out and talking about the development of it. So there's a lot of different factors to this. First of all, it cannot strictly just be a league that is based upon strictly developing players for the national team. it's supposed to work in different ways, right? With a business proposition where you want to create a competitive business on the field, where you want to charge people money to come watch players who deserve to be watched. You want to create clubs who can compete in CONCACAF competitions against top Mexican opposition. You want to create clubs who can go toe-to-toe with MLS like they've done this week and beat MLS opposition. And in the same time, create a business that is profitable and that can be sustainable while also developing players that can obviously get opportunities and get into the national team. So I think all of that means has got to be that word balance, right? And I think Jesse Marsh understands that the Canadian Premier League cannot simply be playing 17, 18, and 19-year-olds, which is the clip a lot of people heard, because we need to get people to pay money to watch it. We need these clubs to be competitive, to thrive, and to survive. But we also understand that, you know, they have provided opportunities for players at Major League Soccer level who haven't quite made it at MLS to get opportunities to play competitive minutes. So I think it's a long answer to what is a pretty strict, obvious answer, is that yes, developing players to the national team is very important, but it cannot be the only requirement.
How do you balance those two things? Because recently we heard the news of Bo Manning being out at TFC, and there could be many reasons as to why that's the case. But I remember thinking to myself, watching Cope, thinking the way Jacob Schaffelberg is playing alone, people should be asking questions within TFC and their academy as to how is he not doing this week in and week out for us. But at the time, you know, some people could have made the argument, well, we have a better option right now, and my job is to keep my job. And so, you know, he found minutes elsewhere, and now he might find himself moving to Europe. So how do you balance those two things in terms of being competitive, putting out your best starting 11, but also growing a culture where you're bringing players through?
Well, I think a lot of it is relationship building. I think a lot of it is understanding that there are responsibilities to help the national team while also helping yourself. I mean, you mentioned the Jacob Schaffelberg situation. I mean, there's been a number of examples where Canadian players have left TFC and gone on to shine elsewhere, right? You know, Lucas McNaughton, they had him. He's on the periphery of the national team. Jason Russell-Rowe is a young player that is going to go on and be a really big player for this national team. They had him, and they lost him to Columbus. I do think there has been a lack of opportunities for Canadian players within the MLS teams. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I suppose they have far bigger budgets. They can cast their net far wider. And if they want to spend money on a player, whether he's Austrian or whether he's Scottish or wherever, they can find those players, right? So we saw that with the Whitecaps, and the way that they're playing right now says a lot about their recruitment has been, I think, done very well over the last couple of years, which can't be said about Toronto FC. So it is a balance, but understanding that I think that ultimately it is the fact that these players are connected more to Canadians, and when Canadians go to watch them, they like, oh, that's a Canadian player who plays for the national team, and that will get them into the seats to watch them. And I know there's this fascination in this country about we need to sign more players from Europe and get these Italians in and sell tickets, but I think it's shown that we have now an opportunity to see that, look, we can make our own heroes, and there's nothing wrong with getting behind them.
I want to ask you a different version of that question in terms of players from Europe, and that would be in the national team setup. I found it really interesting that 19 of the 31 players that featured when Canada faced Colombia, you know, played domestically in North America. I remember Jurgen Klinsmann saying, we need guys getting real minutes in Europe for our national team to be outstanding. Their entire team plays in Europe, and yet the golden generation hasn't really taken the next step. Do you think we're at a point where it doesn't necessarily matter where you play, it matters how you're playing and in what form you come into a camp in terms of who can be playing at the highest level?
Yeah, I think there's two answers to that question, mate. I think short term, it doesn't matter. When you're a national team coach, how you receive those players, there are a lot of different circumstances to it. So let's just take Copa America, what we're talking about right now. How Jesse Marsh received someone like Jacob Schaffelberg, he received him in really good form. playing for Nashville, playing in CONCACAF against Lionel Messi, full of confidence and form, and not burned out by playing in a full domestic season where he's played 45 to 50 games in Europe. So that has helped him this year. While I would say that the long-term format would be that there can still be no debate that for a player to be better, it is the better place to be is to go into Europe. But again, there are circumstances involved in that answer. Where do you go? Tejan Buchanan is an example of this, where we all wish him the best recovering from his broken leg, bless him. You know, he chose to go to Inter Milan and options were limited for him. Stefan Eustachio, one of our best players, didn't get many minutes in the second half of the season with Porto. Well, he was brilliant prior to that, right? So that was a manager's decision. So there's one thing to say, of course, you want them playing at the highest level, but you ultimately want them playing. If they're not playing, they're not serving you well at all, right? So I think that answers the question in terms of finding that blend. Of course, I think you would prefer Kone now going to Marseille is going to be brilliant, but he's got to play, right? We don't want Kone in 2025 to be coming back playing in the Nations League in the Gold Cup and we're going, well, he just got a few minutes this season at Marseille because he's just stunted his development. Well, he could have been playing 46 games for Watford. So, you know, there's a lot of different factors to it. So, but I do think ultimately Europe has got to be, depending on the league, has got to be, and the opportunities has got to be where these players can get on and thrive.
Ask you some big picture things around Copa before we dial in on the national team. The amount of players we're seeing playing from North American sides across the tournament, not just obviously for Canada. Are we at the point, given there's so many difficulties with us in North America being off of the international football calendar, but are we at the point where, like the rest of the world, we need to stop domestically during international tournaments when you have more than 100 players, you know, missing MLS games, and with the growth of the CPL, that issue is only going to become a bit bigger? Are we getting to that point?
Yeah, we are. And I think that we have to recognize that again, it's back to this whole discussion that we started off with my first answer, is that, you know, the outcomes on the field and people's awareness has got to be balanced with business operations. So I think from a sporting point of view, let's go there first. It is not the right thing to be having games played at all on the same day as a national team. So when, you know, Canada are playing a big moment in Orlando and I'm there and they qualify through the group against Chile, and then I knew, but there's a lot of people going to a Whitecaps game at home in Vancouver or in Toronto or in Montreal, and they're paying the tickets and they've already bought them and they have to go there. We are robbing our country of an opportunity to get those people to galvanize through our national team. That is farcical. That would never happen anywhere else. It's a joke. So, you know, for me, there's got to be more pressure on those leagues to say, okay, if you absolutely have to continue to operate, you're okay with missing these players, then rearrange your games to make sure that they're not on the same day. And I don't care whether they say, well, we didn't know whether they're going to finish first or second. You've got to figure it out. What the Canadian Premier League have done is they've figured it out. They've made sure that they will move games away from national team games windows so it can be aired on One Soccer, so there's no CPL game clashing with a women's national team game, let alone a men's. So, you know, they're figuring it out. Even if you have to move a game by an hour or two, you have to figure it out in this day and age now where most games are streamed on Apple and you haven't got windows of broadcasts where you have to play at that moment. There's opportunities there to figure it out. I think MLS understand that. And then, of course, in 2026, they're going to have to really sort that out, because when the World Cup comes, you know, it's obviously good for business that you can say, oh, the World Cup's playing, come and watch our game, we've got MLS here. But you can't be playing games at the same time as a World Cup in the same country. That would be a joke.
I love that you took us to the World Cup, because that's my next question and maybe my next concern. For me, Copa in the United States, not only for the federations, but for everyone, is a bit of a dry run as to what we can expect for the World Cup. Not that the United States hasn't hosted big events before, big soccer tournaments before, but I think in this day and age, a World Cup, quite frankly, is different. The only like-for-like thing you have would be Olympics. It's having the Super Bowl over and over and over again. And whether it's lack of security, whether it's lack of proper size pitches, whether it's in the city or the outskirts of the city that we live, the real lack of infrastructure in around You know, what will be BMO, which can be congested for an Argos match? Never mind what's going to happen when you have multiple World Cup dates and, you know, a major highway that is anything but a thoroughfare right now. I just really worry. And we're, you know, less than 2 years out now, that we might be a little bit naive as to what a World Cup is going to be like, an expanded World Cup in 2026 and in North America. I'm sure I feel less concerns about what our Mexican friends will have to deal with. But in the United States and Canada, I am pessimistic that we have at this date got it right and prepared.
No, I agree with you. I'll start with the fan, because I think most people don't start with the fan. They end with the fan, right? They think about everything else, right? And a lot of these discussions, there's never really a fan perspective. There's not a fan, you know, representative, or how do we get the fans to talk about this and get them, you know, because a lot of the times those stories are told later. They're not, there's not a lot of ability to think ahead about what can we take care of them. How do we make sure we get them into these stadiums, not lining up on a highway for 3 hours to get to a stadium, or stuck under a tunnel to get to a GO station, right? Like, there's going to be like, how can we make sure that this is taken care of? What I will say to maybe counter that is, in my own personal experience of covering many tournaments, covering a FIFA tournament is very different than covering a Commonwealth tournament. So I would say that I saw in my own eyes just the lack of organization in some factors in some areas that I did not see with FIFA and with Qatar. So they will, I believe, have a lot more ideas around different things, and they will anticipate a lot more scenarios. But I'm with you. It's got to be better. I'm hopeful that it will be. The pitches, of the standard of the pitches, have got to be better inside these NFL stadiums. And, you know, hopefully the tickets are affordable and we get real fans in the stadium as well. That is also very important for the atmosphere. I think we've seen from the European Championships that although the ticket prices on the secondary market are astronomical, when you speak to people who go to the games within the supporters clubs and these countries have got the real fans there, they are not, you know, remortgaging their homes to go to these games. So let's make sure we get real fans in the stadiums and make it affordable.
I've loved being able to essentially, you know, watch soccer from sun up to sundown over the last couple of weeks, but it has given me a great contrast in styles of play, styles of management, styles of officiating, quite frankly, and even styles in terms of utilization of VAR. What has your takeaway, as much as you've been able to consume both, because, you know, from one match to another, I'm seeing rules and, you know, interpreted differently. I'm seeing some things as a play on and some things as, you know, potentially a penalty. What have you noticed by the differences?
Well, in many ways, it's chaos. It frustrates people. It just brings out so many emotions. And I know that people get mad about that stuff, but I just sit back and love it with a smile on my face. I do. I really do. Because that's what sports are about, right? Like, at the end of the day, like, if we scrap it all down and we make it, isn't really important, but it's always more important to us than anything at the moment. And so the fact that it brings out genuine emotion is wonderful. I also think what's pretty special about it is that the world is very different everywhere we go. That's why I love traveling. That's why I love taking my family to travel. You learn and you educate yourself all around the world when you go to different places. And what would be seen as being normal somewhere else is not normal somewhere else. That's just life. So then you take it into football terms and sporting terms. What we're seeing is very similar culturally. In Europe, it's very heavily policed and rules and what you can't do. And elsewhere in South America, it's kind of more relaxed and okay, you can get away with it. It's the same thing, right? And there's a bit more intensity and aggression to things. And You know, this South American style football versus the European football, this is nothing new. You know, this is the World Cup qualifying that's been going on for years, you know, and the intensity and the drama and all of it. And Europe's a bit more relaxed and sideways passing. And, oh, we may score, we may not score. We've got a penalty. It'd be 0-0. And, oh, we get to play an extra 30 minutes. No, you don't get to do that here in South America. You're going to go right to the shootout. You know, it's brilliant in many ways, right? And I love the contrast of it. And I love that Canada stuck to the rules and stuck to adapted to that kind of environment and came out shining from it. So, yeah, it's in many ways what makes it a beautiful game is that it isn't all formulaic and similar everywhere.
I want to know where in the world you can, as a keeper, run to the touchline, save time, touch the ball. By the way, and it's not, not a card, not, nothing. It's a rhetorical question because the answer is nowhere. Well, I mean, evidently, well, Copa, I suppose. But yeah, you mentioned going straight to penalties, which some people felt somewhat harsh. But if you watch many of the Euro games, teams were just looking to get to penalties anyways.
Yeah.
With the amount of minutes that these top players are playing and what the football calendar looks like, and you know, the fact that we are gonna, you know, for some reason have a Club World Cup soon because we can't have enough you know, international events and games, is it inevitable that that's just going to become the standard, that, you know, the load on these players is so much? We could add more substitutions if we want, but at some point there's got to be a breaking point, because again, untrained eye, it seemed like a lot of top players in the Euros were not at their best, whether it's carrying injuries or just carrying, you know, lots of minutes when you add club, domestic competitions, Champions League, et cetera.
Yeah, they're exhausted. No, you know, it's the, you know, the new season kicks off in August and it's the fresh toothpaste you bought from the store. And by the time it comes to the end of the season, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's Harry Kane, Jonathan David, Kylian Mbappe, you name it, you know, you're squeezing that last bit out before you go get a new tube, right? Like that's that they're just, you know, that these guys are playing, you know, 58, 59, 60, 62, 63 games per season. And this is at the very end of them. They're absolutely spent and they're asked to go every single game, by the way. Well, this is very different back to our North American European chat, where every game in Europe matters. Real jeopardy. Every game. Chasing a Champions League spot, trying to win a trophy, battling against relegation. Give us everything that you must give us every single game. And most of those top players we mentioned don't get taken off. They play 90 minutes every match. And that, you know, and so when it gets to this different environment, it's exhaustion. And so in many ways, again, I think we just have to settle for that. International football is never going to pass club football in terms of the elite level, technical quality, overall coaching. The best coaches are in the club game. So in many ways, we have to embrace it and understand that it can lead to, hopefully it can lead to mistakes, which can lead to, you know, entertainment as well. But occasionally we're going to get that dull game where there's just nothing. And I think we saw that a few times, particularly in the Euros this year, where there's just nothing in this game. And sometimes you just got to expect that. It's not great, but it's just part of the sport.
You mentioned managers. I want to get your early impressions of Jesse Marsh, both him and his leadership style, but you know, the big calls that he's made already early. Davies captaincy, new center back partnership, gave the number one goalie shirt to Crapo in terms of style of play, left some of the old guard out of the squad, is bringing in some new young players. What have you made from him? You know, new CEOs of a company, they have their first 100 days where they go around, they meet everyone, they figure out their plan. He had essentially 10 days before it got real. What are your first impressions of him as a skipper?
Yeah, it's been almost flawless. I think my overall impressions for him and everything that you mentioned he's got right on the field. My overall impressions is that, you know, he cares genuinely about his players. And I think he cares genuinely about people. You know, from my own viewing of what, you know, when I see him interact with people, he is understanding that he is the manager. He is the gaffer. He sets the standards. He's pushing them. But he does not want to make it about him. And I know that he wants the players to be talking more. We need to get these players talking more. We need them out there, and we need people to fall in love with them. And I think he understands that. He does not seem to be, as I said, someone that wants to be the face of Canada soccer, which I think is refreshing. He understands it's the players who deserve that. But I do, buddy, really believe that he genuinely cares about people. There's a number of different examples that I've seen from his body language, the way that he takes press conferences on. When players talk, he leans over to them. He has an interest about what they're saying. He looks at them in the eye. A moment that I noticed that when I went to the Argentina game, he said after the game, because Argentina were late coming out the dressing room, that Argentina and Scaloni, the coach, they should be fired. They should be fined, you know, and eventually they were fined. And he actually backtracked and said that, like, he kind of was just joking. He kind of felt bad about it. And then you saw him before the Argentina semifinal. He went up to talk to Scaloni, and he's kind of talking to him about something, and they're putting their arm around him. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure, I'm confident he was talking to him about that. Like, he didn't want him to feel like that he was a jerk and he was trying to get him fined. Like, because he knows as a coach, you do everything you can to get those kind of edges. So I bring all that up to say that I do genuinely think that, first of all, he's got self-awareness and he's a decent human. Now, of course, with that comes, you know, a bravado and a confidence that you need to bring out in these players as well. And he understands what they need to do to get to another level, but he's got a lot of his decisions right. He ultimately has taken Canada further than anybody could ever have imagined. And I think that this time with them, this month and a half that he's had with them, will build some real treasure points and trust points over the next 2 years that will help him get him ready for 26.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't deliver the very specific questions that are ongoing in my Canadian men's national team group chat. And going into Copa, it was, do we know about the center back partnership and who should be the starting goalie? I think those questions are answered. Bombido, obviously, you know, maybe it's a bit early for him right now, but you can see the promise, certainly. Now the questions are things that people were relatively confident about. The strike partnership of Laren and David, can you get the best out of both of them playing together? And in terms of creating chances, where is the best place for Fonzie? If I talk to you 10 times, I'm going to ask you this question 10 times.
Yeah.
Now that we've seen him at this level, playing where he plays for a club, does it make more sense having him higher up the pitch, or are there better options in terms of balancing out the entire side?
Yeah, lots of great points. First of all, I really like David and Laren as a partnership, and I think they've had a good tournament. And I know people, you know, understand that you measure those players with, you know, goals and assists, right? And so they won't be admitting that they'll be happy with that. But I think that the way they work together, they're running. I think Kyle Laren has reached a level that I've never seen a manager get out of him without the ball. Defensively, he's become a very good center forward. We already know that Jonathan David is an elite level, world-class defensive center forward, and he can show that already. He, by the way, is one of the players I mentioned earlier. I think he's played 58 competitive matches, Jonathan David. So, you know, we saw the results of that in the semifinal. So look, I think that those goals will come. I really believe that. Your point about Alphonso Davies, he's playing in this right position. For me, I understand what people will say. It's been clear that this tournament, the area of weakness for this team has been delivery from wide areas. Schaffelberg's had a good tournament, but there's been opportunities where the balls could have been placed in and had to show more composure. He's talked about that. Richie Larea isn't necessarily by design a right winger. He's a right fullback who can, you know, his delivery in the final third it's not Tejon Buchanan level. Tejon Buchanan didn't start the tournament in great form and then subsequently got injured. Liam Miller's been very inconsistent. They haven't had Junior Hoyler. He's been injured. So those areas are areas where you think, okay, we'll just put Alphonso Davies there and play someone else at left back. But then you're still getting into issues where Fonzie's probably not getting as many touches. He's not playing in the best position. I think defensively, he was excellent in this tournament. You'll have noticed that they conceded that goal against Venezuela from the corner, when they had too many men further forward, and they almost did the same against Di Maria one-on-one in the first game against Argentina. They made an adjustment and they put Alfonso Davies there to make sure that he was defensively solid for that corner because of his pace. So I think there's lots of things that I've seen from Alfonso Davies as the new captain where he has been more selfless and he's done what he needs to do for the best for the team. So I like him in that position. And I think against weaker opposition, which is going to come, you're not going to play these kind of standard of play at the teams a lot. He will be able to be the balance of being a very good left back, getting forward and still being someone who can deliver those balls into the final third once they get more possession.
I would ask you what the setup should be for the three Lions, but it doesn't matter because we already know. We know that Southgate's not going to make any changes. He's going to be the second manager on the pitch to make a substitution. I don't know if I've seen someone take more stick during a tournament and get more praise within a week span, but his resume at this point is becoming undeniable. And having said that, I still don't trust him. I still feel like they're too negative and too pessimistic, but if they end up lifting a trophy, like no one complains about the way Deschamps did it. He did it. You understand the level of scrutiny that seat holds, given the history. The also interesting thing to me is it's a somewhat of a low bar to clear in terms of being a good England manager. Be a good person. Don't have your players hate you. Don't have factions within the group. And then already you're like, top three of all time.
Right.
So what's your read on all of the conversations in the front and back pages of Southgate's tenure as England manager?
Yeah, look, my read is that it's been very cruel, but it's not been surprising. I think, first of all, he's a first-class human being, an outstanding man, one that I don't know personally very well, but got to cover when he was at Aston Villa, and he was exactly the same when he was a player, an elite-level captain from very early age, took a lot of responsibility on, just a good overall human being, but led by example, but very articulate, and has taken too much stick. Ultimately, for a country that is often seen, and I can speak of this because I was born there, I grew up there, is often seen as like the home of football. They do irrational analysis better than anybody else in the world, right? Like they don't, they every minute of every match is overanalyzed and to the point where it's just ridiculous. Like the second game of the tournament, I don't think England have played a good second game in group in the tournament for a long time. And everyone's like, oh, we're done. It's like this idea that you can build into a tournament. It's just, you can't have that. Like it doesn't sell papers. It doesn't sell newspapers. It doesn't get downloads. Like, no, everybody wants to talk about every single minute of every single game. So it just comes with the nature. I do think it does hurt them, undoubtedly. It does definitely hurt them. There's also a level of entitlement sometimes from external media that I think Southgate has done a really good job of trying to say, no, we are not that same England that the rest of the world see. We don't believe that we should definitely win these games. He's done a great job of that. And his record speaks for itself. He's made two major finals back to back in the Euros, a World Cup semi-final, a World Cup quarterfinal. And ultimately he's been, an incredibly successful England manager who's had the job for over 100 games. So, I'm delighted for him. His players, you can tell they like him and they respect him, and that's really all that matters.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the Southgate, pre and post, no semi-final in two decades, and I understand it's a golden generation. Every federation says this is their golden generation to a certain extent, but you're talking Scholes, Rooney, Lampard, Gerrard, like world-class players, and didn't have close to these types of results. Three semifinals and 26 competitions before Southgate. 3-4 after. I don't know if any player, for me, sometimes you put on that shirt with the three Lions and, you play a bit smaller. I don't know if any player, for me, defines the Southgate era more than Jordan Pickford. Because he puts on that keeper shirt for England, he plays bigger, specifically in penalty kicks. You, which I love, have studied Pence. Talk to me about him. Much has been made of the tight shot of his water bottle and, you know, the research and whatnot. But talk to me about how he's seemed to grown into, you know, the role. And it's not like there were bad keepers before: David Seaman, Joe Shilton, David James, Joe Hart, who many physically, technically, I would pick over Pickford. But when it comes for playing for your country, right, he's always been dependable.
He's been very dependable. It's a great word. And he's never worried about the moment and the occasion. And for somebody who plays at Everton, and I'm not talking Everton down, they're a wonderful big football club, but he hasn't had many of those moments for his club. So he's not even been overawed by them. And as you mentioned, most of his big games have always been in an England shirt. And so, look, he shines in the penalties as well, and he deserves every credit. But again, this is down to Southgate, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink, the others. You know, what I know about penalties is probably a lot more than most, but what they know is way more than me. Okay. So I can see it. And I've seen it now for a number of years about what they did. You know, it started for me in the World Cup against Colombia. And you can see it. Like, they got away from it a little bit at home in the Euros against Italy when they threw two guys on at the end and they didn't put them in the right area. And I was concerned for Southgate at that point. What is he doing? But, you know, they've clearly got the right people in charge. There's everything about penalties that you can look into. There's so many different areas, you know, that they did it. You look at the five penalties that they took against Switzerland. They were exemplary. Pickford knew a lot of what was going on. People talk about the war ball. It's got nothing to do with it for me. It's about reading the energy of everybody coming up, understanding where you need to do, about where you go to get the ball afterwards. That's very important. That doesn't get discussed on a broadcast because you don't see it because you get cut to tight shots and replays. But what the goalie does with the ball afterwards, the body language of a player going up to the goalie after he takes it to say that you're not alone, we're still in this with you. When you walk back to your team afterwards, whether you miss or you score, a player is designated to walk towards you, to talk to you about it, to send another message to the other team that you're not alone as you make that walk back. There's so many different factors that have gone into it now that they didn't have years ago that are working. And so, you know, for me, it's great to see that Southgate, who learned the hard way in 1996 when he missed the penalty, his first ever one, by the way, which speaks again to the lack of preparation against Germany in a semi-final that Terry Venables never made one change in 120 minutes. That also gets forgotten about, which is today is just remarkable. It just says everything that, you know, that they've done a great job on that. I'm delighted for Pickford that he's got his glory as well. And we'll just have to find out whether it's going to be enough.
Well, you said you could see it. What can you see? Because I see a bunch of guys who now take pens for their clubs. Cole Palmer takes pens from their clubs. Tony might be one of the best penalty takers in the world. The guy doesn't look at the ball, never mind. Yeah. Barely has a run-up. The fact that you can take off Foden and Kane and feel confident that you have five plus, if it has to get there, people who are taking them, you know, willing to step up for their club. To me, I was like, you have an abundance of people who take pens regularly. And one of the first pens taken by the opposition was by a center back who had a great game, but is not, you know, certainly someone you want at the spot. But what do you see in terms of the psychology and the sociology and the method around penalties? Because so many of these games end up being decided by them.
Yeah, lots of things. Like I said, I mentioned earlier, some of them, just to add on to that, like, again, it's the body language, it's the placement of the ball, it's understanding that who you're talking to, it's the order that you take them in. The fourth penalty taker is absolutely crucial. Whether you flip the coin and you win first or go second, obviously the percentage of going first is very important because you have less penalties of jeopardy. Ultimately, if you do the math, if you shoot first, then if you shoot first and you score your first four, that fourth penalty, if they score the first three, is way more of jeopardy than it would be if you're taking it first than it would be if you're taking it second. So it's simple mathematics. So the fourth penalty taker has to be your best one other than your first penalty taker. Those things. The other thing is timing after the whistle's blown. Like, you read autobiographies from Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, Jamie Carragher talks about this, is that when they took penalties at major tournaments, they could not wait for that whistle to be blown, so much so that friends of mine in the media that have written books about this, Ben Littleton, Simon Cooper, they did all the data after this, that they put the research into this, that the moment that an athlete leaves the blocks in a 100-meter race, when they fire the gun, that the ability to run right away after that, that timing right after it to get out of the blocks in a 100-meter race is so tiny. You've got to get out right away. England penalty takers were leveled against that from the moment the whistle was blown. It was this, I can't wait to get it over with, blow the whistle, I just need to kick this ball. And now when you watch them, they take the penalties and these players are taking their time. The whistle does not trigger them to start running to take up the penalty. The whistle just tells them you are now allowed to take it, take your time to win. To the point where you'll watch someone, you're like, how long is he taking here to actually take this, right? So it's been transformed by data and research, and like anything, you know, management and analytics have come in and helped them with it.
The other thing we've seen an increase in across the board is, you know, the stutter step approach. Basically waiting for a keeper to decide and then passing it into the back of the net on the other side. I always feel a little bit concerned. I'd rather just you put your laces through it and get on with it, because if you put it in a good spot, it doesn't matter what the keeper does. But why do you think we've seen an increase?
Well, goalies have never been better at stopping penalties. Never been better, you know, and in major tournaments, you know, a successful penalty rate around the world is in a league is around about 80%. It drops almost automatically to 70% in a major tournament. So, you know, that's right away. That's lots of reasons for that, because it just means so much more. But, you know, goalkeepers, Emi Martinez has led the way with this, but they're just elite at reading off the foot. They're elite at understanding your run up, where you're going to go, your eye, everything like that. So they are trying to, the player is trying to get any advantage that they can to make sure that you can find a way that if you move and then I've got to be the ability to go one way or the other, then I beat you, right? And so the elite goalies have the ability now to stay the entire time and feel like that they can back their shot. Now, if you put a penalty, like you said, like Harry Kane did in the semifinal, and it just goes into the far corner, no goalkeeper can save that, right? But the goalkeeper is banking on the fact that nerves and lack of experience is that most penalty takers are not going to be like Kane, because the majority of the ones I'm going to face in a shootout aren't always going to take it for their clubs, and they're not always going to be able to hit the final corner.
Lastly, it's coming home, isn't it? Is it? Can I believe?
Of course you can. Let's do it. Why not? Let's believe. You know, I didn't back England at the start. One, because I never want to believe that I can back them, because once your heart comes over your head, you know, as an analyst, you know this too. You know, we have the fortune and blessing to talk about sports, and people have, downloaded us and listened to us, and it's immensely, you know, the gratitude is immense for that. But when it comes to analyzing a game where your club is involved, your team is involved, your heart always rules over your head. You cannot rationally analyze the game properly. That's why I didn't pick England to win it. But what I would say is that, you know, I firmly believe in sports, this notion that you have to learn to lose before you learn how to win. I really believe there's so many patterns to that in all these sports that you and I love. And if you look at England and their trail to get here, winning the 2017 under 20 World Cup, trying to get to the World Cup final, not getting there quietly, that beating getting there in Europe and then in the Euro final, losing to Italy, like the team has been trending in that direction more than any team in the Euros. That's what I would say. Although Spain are a disaster as an opposition for England, because they will outpass you and out technically you, and they're going to be chasing shadows for a long time. So they're going to have a lot of luck, a goal from a set piece or something go their way. But they, as I said, this direction of them trending has been going in the right direction for a while.
Yeah, I'm just hoping they can just reproduce a Greece-like performance. Just park the bus, nick a goal somehow, and just claw your way to the finish line. If we know there will be no changes, but if Gareth says, right, KJ, I'm just ringing you, I just middle of the night, need some advice, starting 11, Kane hasn't really looked at his best. You know, if I'm playing three at the back, do I make some changes there? Can I get 90 minutes out of Luke Shaw? If he gave you the ability to just come up with the team sheet, come up with the starting 11, who are you putting down first?
I'd ask him right away, can Luke Shaw play 9 minutes? Like, I'm big on balance, and I also love left footers. So give me left footers, because the passing range is very different. The ability to open up a game is very different. You get him down in the final third, and Trippier has been fine, but the delivery in the final third has been shocking because he's just not used to it in that area of the pitch. It's just different when you have a left footer going down the flank and the ability to cross the ball in that way. So that's the big question for me, is that he came on at halftime. Can he start the game? Because you can't make the changes at halftime and put him on if you're down 2-0, it's over, right? So, like, can he play the game? Can he give us 65, 70 minutes? I'd rather he start than come on.
Well, another reason why Southgate is giving me a heart attack is because to leave Ben Chilwell and Tyreek Mitchell home, not knowing, that you would make it far enough for Luke Shaw to be able to play.
Great point,
is a gutsy call, but we're here, and who knows what we have, and he could legitimately go from having beer thrown at him to not having to buy a beer in that country for the rest of his life. So
get a knighthood.
That's right. He certainly could. And if they bring it home, should. As should you, my friend. Thank you so much for this.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Keep up the great work. Love to the family.
Thanks so much to Christian Jack for making the time. He was just out at Starlight Stadium on the West Coast, now back in Ontario. And although he's very busy, he made time for us. He's very busy leading the content team at the Canadian Premier League. Give them a follow at CPL Soccer. You can find their content on One Soccer, on Fubo TV, and on their website, canpl.ca. And also make sure you're giving KJ a follow as well. At Christian Jack is the handle on IG. I don't know if I can handle another 120 minutes plus injury time plus potentially penalties of England soccer, but I'm certainly looking forward to it. And the big moments in terms of soccer in this country aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Our women's national team is getting ready to defend their Olympic gold medal. Entirely different side. The game has grown vastly from now to Tokyo, but I'm looking forward to see them compete in Paris. We are going to continue to talk about that and break that down on upcoming episodes of the Going Deep podcast. So if you love footy, stay locked right here. Be sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening.